From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, President Bush returns from the Middle East, where he has been touring with a three-point agenda: peace, Iran, and oil. Or, as some may have heard it, Iran, Iran, and Iran. The week's Susan Caskey has been following the commentaries from a uniformly skeptical, no, make that scornful, Mideast and Persian Gulf press. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Let's start with Iran. Despite the recent NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, concluding that Iran halted nuclear weapons research in 2005, the president used his trip to wave more red flags about what he called the Iranian threat to the region and the world. How did that go over?
You said scornful. That's a good word to use. The Iranian press was stressing the entire time that while Bush was touring the region, Mohammad al-Baradei, who's the head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, was actually in Tehran meeting with a bunch of Iranian bigwigs. And in editorial after editorial, they're saying, we have concluded a new agreement to lay to rest all issues in the next 4 weeks. And therefore, you know, Bush is just spouting empty propaganda. But the interesting thing was that that was echoed in the Arab world. There were plenty of Arab newspapers that agreed and said, yes, we too think that when Bush says that Iran is a threat, he has no leg to stand on.
And this is interesting because they are in the very region that is presumably most threatened by Iran's nuclear ambitions.
What was interesting about the reaction was that much of the skepticism came from newspapers in countries that are U.S. allies, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan. One Egyptian newspaper, Al Haram, in a commentary by Imad Urian, he said the speech was in fact a declaration of war, reflecting the continuation of current U.S. administration desire to devour Iran militarily. And then in a Jordanian paper, Al Rai, an editorial said, we do not underestimate the threat of Iranian nuclear armament or that of the Iranian role in the region, but we cannot accept Bush's attempt to promote the Iranian danger as more severe than the Israeli danger or to depict Iran as an alternative enemy to the Arabs. And that was a theme that I saw in several different newspapers across the region saying, you know, Bush has come here and he's trying to tell us that Iran is our enemy, but we all really know that Israel is the enemy and we won't let him tell us any different.
Let's turn to President Bush's attempts in Israel and Palestine to scramble to get a Palestinian state formed by the end of 2008, just as he's turning out the lights on his presidency. The reaction from the Arab press, though, was simple incredulousness, eh?
It was. In fact, it seems like in the Arab press, President Bush cannot catch a break right now. He was the first president to use the term occupation. Several newspapers commented on his use of the word, but in fact, as one, Saudi Arabia's Arab News said, we should be excited by his call for an end to the Israeli occupation, all the more so because occupation is a word so rarely used by the Americans. But then the editorial went on to say, unfortunately, we can be absolutely certain that Washington is not going to exert the pressure needed to force the Israelis to make concessions. That President Bush simply does not have the clout right now.
In fact, I actually read that piece and concluded with the thought, everything he touches turns to dust and ashes.
The harsh words, yes. Quote after quote. One Jordanian paper said he has proved a disaster. Another Jordanian paper said Bush : failure.
The third leg of the stool on this trip was oil. He specifically wanted Saudi Arabia to boost production in order to lower prices and help the flagging U.S. economy. But he kind of did an end run around the oil minister of Saudi Arabia and went directly to the king, sort of hat in hand, if not actually on bended knee. How did that play?
Well, it didn't turn out so well because he did not win any concessions on oil prices. And in fact, the very next day, in a newspaper called Al Jazeera, which is not the Qatar-based television station, but a newspaper in Saudi Arabia of the same name, they had an editorial the next day saying, well, the U.S. is worried about the hike in oil price. This is why it is in the U.S. interest not to push the region into confrontations, especially regarding the Iranian nuclear file. So that was a warning from Saudi Arabia saying, you know, if you're upset about oil, then you really want peace and stability in the region, and we should not be doing any saber rattling with regard to Iran.
Is it fair to say then that the three goals of this trip were sort of mutually contradictory, to make a bogeyman of Iran and to find peace between Israel and Palestine, and also to stabilize oil prices? Was that an impossible agenda from the start?
Well, that's certainly the way the region saw it. There was one editorial in an Egyptian paper saying, did you come to spread peace or to sow the seeds of war? And as far as the third goal of the trip goes, several editorials in leading Arab papers, including Al-Quds Al-Arabi, which is out of London, it came out and said the point of this trip was oil prices. The goal was not peace. The goal was not anything to do with the Palestinians.
Susan, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Caskey is the international editor at The Week magazine.
On January 6th, three American warships and five Iranian speedboats confronted each other in the Strait of Hormuz. American officials said the Iranian vessels behaved aggressively. The Iranian government said the incident was peaceful, blown out of proportion by the U.S., and each government released a videotape to support its version and called the other's videotape baloney. In the nearly 2 weeks since, the story has played out like a geopolitical Rashomon. Bill Arkin is a military affairs expert and an online columnist for The Washington Post. He says that the two antagonists interact all the time in the Strait. This time it became a media event because this time the Pentagon decided to have a press conference.
Why did it decide to have a press conference? It decided to have a press conference because the president of the United States was about to go to the Persian Gulf. I can't help then, therefore, to see the entire incident as part of a broader strategic communication effort on the part of the administration, and that was to put a big giant banner behind the president when he spoke about Iran, and that banner was to say, these are the bad guys and we've proven it this week by showing you the videotape.
What do we know about this Pentagon video? It shows the Iranian speedboats buzzing around the warship. We hear an American sailor trying to communicate with the boat and to warn it against aggressive action. Then we hear some weird, accented, almost Boris Badenov-type voice saying that something would explode in a few minutes.
The court immediately turned in clear.
It will explode
after a few minutes.
What we were watching in the pictures was not necessarily what was associated in the audio. The two were melded together, and there was a manipulation involved there that people were made to think that the actual speedboats were conveying the words that were on the video.
So there was an intention to deceive.
Well, there was a creative process that went on, Brooke. You know, it's... I think that probably at the White House level, at the administration level, there was an intention to create a video moment and confrontation that was going to be used for political purposes. But what's being obscured by how clumsy the Pentagon put together this video was that the Iranian speedboats in fact were buzzing the American ships, that they in fact were at least exhibiting potentially aggressive behavior. And had we known on January 7th when the Pentagon revealed this incident that there had been other incidents involving the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy and that there had in fact been an incident on December 19th where a U.S. ship felt so threatened that it fired warning shots against similar Iranian speedboats, then we might have had some context to understand what we were looking at. But instead, what happened was they put out this video, which seemed to them to be the slam dunk of confrontations, and that video ended up being flawed.
And part of what made it flawed was this accented voice talking about the explosion. Who is the Filipino monkey?
Who knows? It's a prankster. It's somebody either operating from one of the Gulf states or operating from Iran who speaks on Channel 16, which is an open channel of bridge-to-bridge communications amongst all ships. This is sort of the equivalent, if you will, of CB radios at sea. Anybody can break in. What was most interesting about it, Brooke, is that it had happened before, and this admiral who stood before the Pentagon press corps didn't say so, and my guess is, Brooke, he didn't know it.
Everybody else knew it, and the Iranians knew it, so they could accuse the tape of being doctored, which it was, and then respond with their own tape showing a peaceful interaction in the Strait on that day. Which tape was truer or falser?
Well, here's the irony. Both tapes are true because the Iranians showed a peaceful passage with peaceful audio, like the American videotape. The audio and the video were put together from two separate incidents. What we now know about what happened that morning was at about 6 a.m. in the morning, these three American ships passed through the eastern part of the Strait of Hormuz. They were met by and interrogated by an Iranian Navy vessel, and then they were allowed to pass peaceably. And about 2 hours later, at the western side of the Straits of Hormuz, these three Navy ships were approached by these five speedboats of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is a sort of paramilitary terrorist organization that is independent of the Iranian Navy. And what the Iranians did in releasing their videotape was they released the audio from the 6 a.m. passing together with the speedboat video, and then they tried to make it look as if those two were synonymous.
How would you assess the American media coverage of this event as it unfolded?
What the media failed in my mind, was asking some of the obvious questions from the get-go. Was this the only incident that had ever occurred? How did the Navy assess this in terms of the seriousness in comparison to other things that had happened? And I think that to some degree, the video itself, this manufactured video from the Pentagon, set the tone of what the questions were, because most of the questions at the press conference were explained to us what we're looking at. And so that swamped other questions about trying to put some context into this incident.
Do you think this incident has harmed our credibility in the region? Do we have any left?
The presumption is certainly that this administration is a liar. I think it was the clumsiness of the Bush administration itself and the clumsiness of the Pentagon that as much exposed all of the problems associated with this story as it was anybody who wrote anything in the news media.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Arkin is a military affairs expert and an online columnist for The Washington Post.
Coming up, the Democrat who wasn't there and why the Brits can't get enough of our American primaries.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, MSNBC staged a debate among Democratic presidential candidates.
Tonight, with the next crucial contest, the Nevada caucuses, just days away. For the first time, it's down to three.
Originally, it was supposed to be down to four candidates, but just before it was to be held, MSNBC changed its mind, deciding to go with the top three candidates instead, leaving out Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. He swiftly filed suit, charging breach of contract, and a judge ruled that if he was left out, the debate could not take place. At the last minute, the Nevada Supreme Court stepped in and overturned the lower court's decision, saying that the agreement between Kucinich and MSNBC was not a legal contract and that prior restraint, that is, stopping the debate before a violation had even been committed, would be an overreaction. So Tuesday night's debate proceeded without Democrat number four. Dennis Kucinich says it's not just the legal decision with which he disagrees.
It's the principle of whether or not General Electric, which owns NBC, should be in a position of being able to stage a debate with candidates who they've supported financially and limit the debate so that the issues that would be against General Electric's financial interest would not have a chance to be discussed. For example, nuclear power or the war in Iraq. You know, GE makes nuclear power plants. I'm for a nuclear-free energy policy. They make money off of war.
So you're saying that the programmers at MSNBC or NBC are taking marching orders from GE and aren't just trying to create a more coherent environment in which ideas can be discussed at length with fewer candidates?
I think it's absolutely naive to think that General Electric would not have a hand in this kind of a decision where their corporate interests are at stake.
Bob Franken, a correspondent for MSNBC, wrote in the Huffington Post, "You had your chance." Quote, "NBC finally concluded that the time had come for an uncluttered competition between the three who had any chance whatsoever of making the Democratic nomination. If GE was so dead set keeping you off the air, you wouldn't have participated in all those previous debates."
But you know what, though? With a larger field, these issues don't come into focus. And with a smaller field, they do. Having been excluded now from the fourth debate, this is part of an effort to try to basically create a presidential debate where there's really no differences at all. General Electric generally doesn't want to have the truth out, and this four-person debate would have been a great place to be able to see the differences not just between the candidates, but see where the real truths that lie in this election that the American people have a right to hear.
I understand that you feel that these ideas have not gotten a full airing on television. I think that's probably true. But aren't you basically saying that all the candidates polling less than you shouldn't be there cluttering it up? You're setting the standard at four. NBC set its standard at three candidates.
I've established that I met the criteria that NBC first set, and they established by giving me an invitation. But a much bigger matter than my candidacy. Media today can decide who's a candidate based on who they cover. And they can decide who's a candidate based on who they let into a debate. That's not good for democracy.
People often exaggerate the power of the media. The media certainly didn't create the campaign, for instance, this time around for Mike Huckabee, nor did they create the campaign for Jimmy Carter years and years ago. It was the voters that did that. And although I understand and respect your objection to media ownership and the concentration of ownership, isn't it better that the government stay out of deciding who is on the air?
Actually, no. This is a fundamental right in a democratic society, have a free media, but the idea of broadcast media not being regulated is a problem. I mean, because the airwaves belong to the public. They don't belong to NBC.
This is a cable network, which doesn't use public airwaves. Aren't they free legally to do as they wish?
Actually, they have to sign, in many cases, agreements with communities to be able to have cable franchise in local communities that then carry these stations. And it's very closely patterning the FCC Act of 1934, which says that broadcast media must serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Now, either we have to bring cable networks into correspondence with the FCC Act of 1934, or we have to look at the underlying concerns, for example, defense contractors being involved through business relationship with media interests, or of media executives being able to make contributions to presidential campaigns.
One point on which the Nevada Supreme Court disagreed with the lower court was on the issue of prior restraint. Even if you had been within your legal rights, Congressman, to object, no crime would have been committed until the debate began. Don't you think that preventing an event from taking place ahead of time dangerous precedent?
I've never tried to say what should or shouldn't go on the air. What we argued is that it's up to the judge to determine what he felt was an effective remedy. But I will tell you this, that this legal action isn't over with yet, because there are other elements of law here that haven't yet been explored, to which GE and NBC will be held accountable. My attorneys have determined that there's reasons to pursue this matter civilly, and we're going to do that.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be on it.
Ohio Representative Dennis Kucinich is seeking the Democratic presidential nomination. We all know that the race for president rules the news, but listen to the numbers. Election night ratings for CNN reportedly have almost doubled from the 2004 election cycle, and Fox's are up 60%. But U.S. election fever is not limited to the U.S. The Christian Science Monitor reported recently that people everywhere, from Japan to Kenya to the Gaza Strip, are captivated by images of a woman and a black man running for president of the United States. Even in Britain, where political apathy is as ubiquitous as Earl Grey, the media are awash in American politics. Janet Daly, a columnist for the conservative British newspaper The Daily Telegraph, is following the race from London. She joins us now. Janet, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So can we start with the BBC? You wrote that commentators there are trying to, quote, decide whether American politics is quaintly naive or stirringly robust.
Well, you have to understand that BBC commentary, particularly about politics, is characterized by a laconic cynicism, which would be quite shocking, I think, to most Americans. This is relatively new in Britain, this kind of extraordinary disrespect for the whole democratic apparatus and everybody involved in it. But the roots are really in a kind of aristocratic disdain for democratic politics. It goes back to a kind of paternalistic attitude, which holds the public opinion generally in very low esteem. So it isn't entirely new, but over the last 20 years it has become very marked.
So if politicking in England prompts from the BBC cynicism and irony, you noted that when it comes to American politics, it became downright condescending and supercilious.
Oh, yeah. There was a curious ambivalence. On the one hand, the correspondents who were sent out there kind of got into it. It was almost impossible to avoid the infectious enthusiasm. And then you could almost hear them catching themselves and saying, no, it can't possibly be as exciting as this. There's no reason to get juvenile about this, especially when they were relating to the British audience, doing it two-way, for example, with a British news presenter. I think they felt a bit embarrassed, about having gone so gung-ho. And so you'd get this attempt to present it all as a rather parochial, ingenuous, naive, rather quaint process. Entertaining, mind you, but they'd elected Hillary Clinton to the presidency about 6 months ago, and so they were completely floored by the result in Iowa and had to readjust their expectations.
This makes them no different from the American media.
No, I realize that, yes. Except that Mike Huckabee, BBC couldn't cope with him at all. I mean, they're perfectly accustomed to the idea of the Christian evangelical influence on American politics. But the idea that the guy could be witty and funny and engaging, you could sort of hear the gears grinding.
You told us that every major outlet, print and broadcast, had a correspondent or two or three there following the candidates from state to state, and that ratings in Britain for this stuff is really good. So why do they care so much more this time?
There is a serious crisis of political confidence in Britain. Voter apathy is now epidemic. We used to have very high turnouts for elections here, and we don't any longer. And I think that one of the reasons that the British media is becoming so fascinated, almost hypnotically fascinated, by the American democratic experience is that it does seem to be much, much more lively and engaging, particularly to the young.
So how did the tone of the coverage change in the British media after the upsets in Iowa, followed by what happened in New Hampshire?
It was just as embarrassing for the British commentariat as it was for the American commentariat. And the broadcast media generally was sort of all over the place after that, and after Michigan as well. I mean, to give you another example of the desire to play down the obvious excitement and optimism of this presidential campaign. When Romney won in Michigan, I heard a television commentator say, not from the BBC, I must say, this is a real problem for the Republicans. They've had a different winner in every primary. So the question that people must be asking is, are the voters spoiled for choice, or are they just not very impressed by anybody?
Well, Janet, I take your point, and yet that sort of analysis doesn't strike me as entirely foreign from the American variety. Have you been watching it from both sides of the pond?
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly true that all of this stuff gets said on the American media, but it's not exclusively what's being said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the interesting thing is, because I'm kind of switching back and forth through the miracle of digital media between American coverage and British coverage, when I switch back to the British coverage, it's like a cloud has passed in front of the sun. All of it tinged, I must say, with a hint of envy.
Well, let's get to that issue, which you raise so tantalizingly in your column. You've suggested that the coverage of the primary is leading some in the British media to ask, why can't we have this? Given all the condescension, given all the apathy, given the structure of British politics, can you have it? Would you even want to?
A lot of people would want to. A lot of people would want almost anything that would reinvigorate the interest and feeling that politics was actually about the interests of ordinary people. I think it would be very difficult to overcome the cynicism and the alienation now. The idea that people were opening their own living rooms, their own homes, to discussions with their neighbours about who should be supported in the primary was truly astonishing in a British context. On the one hand, it was wonderful, and on the other hand, it was bizarre. I think there is a real ambivalence about this on the part of the British media. How seriously should we take this model without making ourselves look ridiculous in terms of British attitudes toward political life?
Janet, thank you so much.
Quite all right.
Janet Daly is a columnist for the Daily Telegraph.
One of the worst crimes a reporter can commit in pursuit of an exclusive is checkbook journalism. As stated in the New York Times Company Policy on Ethics in Journalism, quote, "We do not pay for interviews or unpublished documents. To do so would create an incentive for sources to falsify material and would cast into doubt the genuineness of much that we publish." It seems so obvious, but in this month's Columbia Journalism Review, journalist and NYU professor Robert Boynton argues that it isn't. When reporters spend months or years with a source, Boynton says, they may find themselves reconsidering this fundamental of journalism.
Is it true that we really owe these people absolutely nothing? It seemed to me and many people I talked to that that was not true, that there was some sense in which we owed the people we write about something, and that something quite profound took place between the people we write about and ourselves. And I was wondering about the degree to which any kind of remuneration applied to that.
Cite some examples of stories in which money was paid and an important story was the result.
There's a long history of examples where money traded hands. In 1912, the New York Times scooped the competition with an exclusive interview with the Titanic wireless operator by paying $1,000 for the story. In the 1930s, the Hearst newspaper chain paid the legal bills of the defendant in the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case in order to ensure scoops during the trial. And there have been many cases more recently in which money has factored in journalism.
So how long has this actually been taboo? Since when is paying a source, you know, like wearing a white before Memorial Day?
I would guess that it probably originates from around the same time that the notion that mainstream journalism had to be objective, which would be the turn of the century. But I think that the fact is that compensating the people we write about, whether through dinners or parties or
putting their name in the paper or flogging their point of view,
there's always some sort of a transaction that takes place in any act of journalism between a journalist and a subject, especially in a long-form piece that takes a long time to report. But we always, it seems, as a culture, as a journalistic culture, pull back when it comes to anything having to do with money. And yet, money, as we all know, is a very important reason for doing what we do, if not the only reason. And I've always just questioned that taboo on talking about money.
One of the most bizarre examples of checkbook journalism was the case of Jeffrey McDonald, the doctor who was tried for killing his family. Journalist Joe McGinnis was writing a book about the case, and he agreed to pay McDonald for his cooperation with a portion of his royalties. Now, McDonald believed that McGinnis would depict him as innocent, but when the book, Fatal Vision, came out, he was portrayed as a killer. So McDonald sued McGinnis, saying that the writer had agreed to maintain the integrity of McDonald's story.
And that was the petard on which McGinnis was hoisted during the trial, where McDonald's lawyer was able to make a very good case that, in fact, McGinnis knew that he believed McDonald was guilty long, long before he ever told McDonald that.
Which created the idea of cross, double cross, triple cross. The case was also notable because it was written about in a famous New Yorker article about 15 years ago by Janet Malcolm, who concluded that putting aside money, that all journalism is inherently dishonest because reporters always hide their motives and go to some lengths to mislead their sources about what they have in mind to begin with.
I disagree with Janet Malcolm in that I believe that there are many forms of journalism that don't involve highly developed deceit and trickery. But I have to say, I think that there is a way in which deceit is an important tool, one of many that journalists use in their articles. What I thought she missed in that article was the fact that journalists are as open to being spun and bought as subjects are.
Now, you invoked the Malcolm piece in your story. Are you suggesting any way that money can actually purify the transaction?
I don't think that money can purify the transaction. I do think that the reality of the situation is that there is some exchange, oftentimes a financial one, involved in many acts of journalism. I think, in general, most of the arrangements that take place wouldn't really offend us if we knew about them, and I think disclosure would be one way to take care of that.
Well, of course, there are many reasons why news organizations don't want any part of this kind of transaction. As the New York Times ethics policy says, it puts doubt as to the motives and therefore the veracity of the people being paid. There's also the slippery slope argument. For example, whenever a high-profile story breaks out in England, the slant of the story by any given paper is entirely determined by which principle in the story they've literally bought into. Is the slippery slope not something we should be afraid of descending?
Absolutely. I would also argue, though, that journalists here, even though no money exchanges hands for the most part, journalists here are also beholden to whichever source decides to talk to him or her, and that kind of bias creeps into all sorts of articles, even without the taint of money.
Rob, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
And, of course, the check's in the mail. Robert Boynton is the director of NYU's Magazine Journalism Program and the author of The New Journalism by Vintage Books.
Coming up, the unintended consequences of well-intended reporting.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Those prone to depression have a good reason to feel worse this week. An article in the New England Journal of Medicine revealed that the effectiveness of 12 popular antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil was misreported by their manufacturers in the medical journals doctors rely on. Here's ABC News.
A review of antidepressant studies just out today found that 94% of all positive studies are published, but only 33% of negative studies ever make it into print.
Congress recognizes that drug manufacturers tend to play up their successful clinical trials and bury their failures, so last year it required drug companies to post announcements of clinical studies in a public database. But compliance has been spotty, and anyway, giving notice that a study is being conducted is not the same as posting the results. And as we learned this week, medical journals offer no antidote to the information deficit. Jeannie Lenzer is an independent investigative medical reporter. She says there is a federal fine for pharma companies who misreport or don't report, but it's no cure.
$10,000. It's meaningless. Even though some of those fines can accumulate after a certain period of time, they get a 30-day warning period, and at $10,000 a day, that's nothing next to the millions of dollars per day that they pull in. And if the past serves as any kind of information, then what we know is that they will ignore these.
Now, the stakes are high financially and in many other ways. For example, you have done reporting involving Eli Lilly, which was testing a drug for anti-incontinence applications, but the drug was fundamentally an antidepressant, and people committed suicide while on the drug. You happened upon this information almost by accident. Tell us about that.
Yes, there was a research scientist who really had a stricken conscience and called me and said that Congress is looking at whether antidepressants cause suicidality or not. And it's natural to wonder, is it really the drug or is it the underlying depression? And what this research scientist, who remains anonymous, said to me was, because they knew there was a question about suicidality with their pills, what they did in this study was they took healthy test subjects, screened them all to not be depressed, and then tested them with this drug that they hoped they would be able to use for urinary incontinence. And what they found was there was about a doubling of the suicidality among these patients. So that sure seemed like important information to patients who were taking that same drug for depression.
But because the drug was not put on the market as an anti-incontinence product, the rules did not require Lilly to disclose the suicide of an otherwise healthy 19-year-old college student in the midst of a trial in its own laboratory.
Exactly. And when I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FDA for all of the serious adverse events and deaths of patients taking this drug, and when I got that database back, it did not include her death, and it didn't include the deaths of at least four other patients. They weren't even patients. These were healthy volunteers who were taking the drugs as part of a clinical trial. And I asked the FDA why they hadn't released these deaths. And they said, because they are a trade secret. And they were a trade secret because the drug didn't make it onto the market for that particular use, for incontinence. But it was being used by many patients for depression.
Now, prescribing physicians basically have two sources of information. One is that which is given to them by the drug companies, which obviously accentuate the positive. Mm-hmm. And the other is medical journals, which presumably are giving the straight dope on how these various trials turn out. But a lot of that doesn't get published.
Journals also have a tendency to publish that which is positive and not to scrutinize the data as carefully as they should. And it's not hard to imagine why. The lion's share of their funding comes from pharmaceutical industry. And there was an incredible case where Mike Wilkes, a physician, analyzed the ad content of one of the leading medical journals and found that the ad content was not accurate in many, if not most, of the cases. And he reported that in this journal, and the journal was besieged by all the pharmaceutical companies that then got together and boycotted the journal. And they lost the lion's share of this journal's income, and they finally had to fire the editors. So that's how serious the problem is for medical journals. On the other hand, it's who's doing the research. And Marcia Angel, a former editor-in-chief at the New England Journal, told me that they were hard-pressed to find 10% that was worthy of publication because the studies are just so bad, and they're bad because, by and large, they're funded by industry. So they're intended to be biased.
It seems to me that there's a very good solution for this at hand, and that would be a change in the law that would allow the FDA to demand and post on the Internet not only the existence of all clinical trials, but the results, and then let it to be sorted out by the medical community. But that's not possible now, is it?
You're right, because right now, under trade secrecy rules, which is what affected the girl that we discussed earlier who committed suicide, her death was considered a trade secret. We need to change things so that anyone's clinical outcome on a trial should never be a trade secret, and that should be available for scrutiny. And I'd also add, not just the results of these trials, but the actual underlying raw data. They need to be available to other scientists for scrutiny.
Do you think the press in general has been vigilant on these issues?
There is a tendency to go to what are considered to be official sources. We don't have enough reporting about whether the people being interviewed actually have financial conflicts of interest. There's a recent article in the New York Times that I read, and I checked all six of the six people who commented on the use of a drug were all in the employ of the manufacturer. Journalists are beginning to ask more of these questions now, but we need to do more work to make sure that we have independent sources and also that we put each new study in perspective. For example, with clotbusters for stroke, everybody got on the bandwagon when this NINS trial came out showing that clotbusters, you know, were helpful with stroke, but they didn't mention that there had been five trials before that in which it either had no effect or it killed more people than it helped. So I think as each new trial comes out, we should always ask ourselves, what has gone before this, and let's put this in perspective.
Jeannie, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jeannie Lenzer is an investigative medical reporter whose work has appeared in the British Medical Journal and Slate.com. Between 1976 and 1983, Argentina was ruled by a brutal military dictatorship called the Junta. Tens of thousands of Argentinians were killed and disappeared in those 7 years. In 1987, The Wall Street Journal reporter Roger Cohen wrote a story about twin Argentinian boys torn from their family by the Junta. His story changed the boys' lives, and for two decades, Cohen believed he changed their lives for the better. This year, he returned to Argentina to discover that he might have been wrong. Cohen wrote about his recent trip to Argentina in the New York Times, where he's now an op-ed columnist. He says that when the junta ruled Argentina, one of their most barbaric acts was to kill women immediately after they'd given birth and kidnap their newborn children.
And the children, several hundred of them over the course of 7 years, were then taken by military or police families who were childless.
Now, some tips from an NGO sent you from Argentina to Paraguay, and the family of a former Argentine military policeman named Samuel Miara. Tell me what you found there.
Well, I went to Paraguay because I'd had a tip from the Abuelas de la Plaza de Mayo and also from a particular family called Rossetti Ross. The father was called Rossetti. The mother who'd been killed was called Ross. That Liliana Ross had given birth to twin boys, and these boys, after the murder of their mother, had been taken by this police officer, Miara, to Asuncion. I went to Asuncion, you know, with no great hope that I would meet him. After all, I was there to say, are you the guy who's stolen two children from a murdered woman? Are you masquerading along with your wife as the parents of these two kids, then 10 years old? I did track him down. I found his house in the suburbs of Asuncion. Miara, a small, swarthy man, comes out smoking a cigarette and asks me who I am. I tell him I'm a reporter for an American paper and what I'm interested in. And to my astonishment, he invites me in. He railed against those who were accusing him of having stolen these children and insisted that these boys who were playing soccer out in the yard were his.
Although they were very fair-skinned and blonde, and he himself, as you say, was quite swarthy.
Perhaps I was projecting this, that they resembled quite strongly their father, Adalberto Rossetti, who had survived by fleeing to Europe after his wife was seized. I went back, I wrote the story, the Wall Street Journal published it prominently on page one. My general feeling was that I had done something good. I had not only shed light on a very dark and painful passage in Argentine history that it behoved all Argentines to know about, for the dead, for Liliana Ross, and indeed for the twins, because however pleasant, quiet, tranquil, and apparently unruffled their existence was in this Asuncion suburb, they were living in a lie.
Miara was jailed in Argentina. It was demonstrated that he was not the biological father of the twins, and he was charged at the time with kidnapping. Subsequently, he would be charged on other human rights violations, crimes against humanity. But when you returned, as far as you knew, these children were the natural-born children of the disappeared couple whom you'd first suspected to be their biological parents. Then what happened?
As it transpired, when the DNA and blood tests were done, which proved that Miara and his wife were not the parents, it was discovered that Liliana Ross and Rossetti were not, in fact, the biological parents. These children were, in fact, born to another couple who'd been in the same prison, and she too, Maria Tolosa was her name, had had twins 3 weeks after Liliana. These children were not the Rossetti Ross children, but they were the Rejado Tolosa children. Now, in this instance, both the parents, then aged 24, both of them medical students, had been murdered. There were no parents around.
So they were victims of exactly the sort of nightmare that you'd suspected, but it was a parallel nightmare. And in this case, there was no natural parent in whose custody the children could go. What happened to them?
An uncle emerged named Eduardo Tolosa, and for a while the children went to stay with him. I'm hearing this at second hand, but what I heard when in Buenos Aires from people who I believe know, they said that it was essentially disastrous, partly because the physical conditions were difficult, partly because the relationship with the uncle was difficult, partly because the boys clung to Mrs. Miara, whom they had formed, obviously, a very intense respond with even after they learned what had happened. In the end, courts determined that they should go and live for a while with a substitute family, quote unquote, family with the physical means to look after the boys, but clearly not a very happy outcome.
So they bounced around, like many foster children do, from one unhappy circumstance to another. Do you know how they fare today?
Well, I don't. The most fascinating thing that has happened is that yesterday evening I received an email from, or at least it said it was from, Matias Rejado Tolosa, one of the boys, now men, 30 years old, born in 1977. He said he had read with fascination my piece. There were important things I didn't know that I should know, and that he wanted to talk to me. So I, of course, sent him greetings. And you know, last summer when he was 10, playing in this yard, and he, of course, didn't know who I was. I've not heard back. We'll see where that goes. I heard from another person when I was writing the column that one of the boys has, in a sense, sided with his biological mother, and one has tended to side more with Mrs. Miara, the woman who raised him for much of his life. But I have no direct knowledge of that. That's indirect.
Now, this is a story about a journalist intervening in people's lives. And in your piece in the Times, you asked aloud, was the intrusion worth it? You've had some time to ponder this. What do you think now?
You know, I stand by what I did. I'm not a psychologist, but I think at some deep level, if the situation you are living is a lie, and the situation these boys were living was one, and moreover, at least the father was complicit in some way in the murder of these children's parents, that situation, I do not believe, can be healthy. I was, however, I think, too flip. There is a flippancy to what we do sometimes. I mean, a flippancy in the sense that we do something and we move on and we perhaps don't examine often enough what exactly has transpired. You know, in this instance, it was much more complex than I imagined because there was no father. But I think in the end, for the dead, for Argentina, and even on balance for the boys, but not in as clear-cut a way as I'd thought, this was to the good.
I'm haunted by the email that you got about you not knowing what you did not know. And so often, as journalists, we encounter situations which seem so clear, but we lack certain information that may change the picture altogether.
You know, I hope and believe this email was genuine, and I certainly don't exclude, going back there if we do make a firm contact. More generally, Argentina lived under terror. When societies emerge from these states, any society emerging has to balance truth with justice. And as you just said, you know, newspapers deal much more easily with clear situations than they do with half-tones. You know, we're presenting the truth, we say, but is it really the truth?
To what extent do you think you would tell other journalists to take care when they take a spade and start digging down into the shallow graves of history?
Whatever journalists do in situations where you've had hundreds of thousands of people killed by a regime, you're only going to, in any event, scratch the surface of the individual cases, and then it's down to the museums and the archives and others to assemble the broader history. But I don't think we should start telling each other to go easy. And in fact, I think today the tendency is more to forget too easily than to dig too stubbornly. So I say dig stubbornly and don't forget.
Well, Roger, thank you very much. Whether it comes from Buenos Aires or the West 40s, we will look forward to the next chapter of this story. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Roger Cohen is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We had help from Jessica McGowdy and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.